Tihe, uriri, tehe, nakonoko, tehe, whaeo, ka tamarama, tehe, moriora. Te mea tuatahi, ko koe te kingi, ona kingi, ko koe te atua, no atua. Kina tina mate, kua hari tō mātou mātou i tarangi, kua hari, hari, hari. Ki ngā hunga ora, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Ki te whare karakia i tūnei, tēnā koe. It is my great pleasure to welcome you tonight to the Cathedral of St. Paul's. Just before we get into the night, I have a few housekeeping details. I've actually never done this before in the cathedral. If there is an earthquake, you drop, cover and hold, whatever that means. I think we know what that means. And if there if there's a fire or after the earthquake is over, we make our way out that door to the car park. Do not head to the glass doors of death. Okay, self-explanatory really, okay? So go that way. It is my great pleasure to welcome you tonight. It is knowing that this is an election year. It is so wonderful to see so many people gather as we embark on a series. This is the first of a series of six different presentations across Wellington in this election year, and we do hope that you will continue on the journey with us. Tonight we are embarking on a journey, and in a moment I'll introduce the person speaking. But just a thought, and after Mihing and welcoming you tonight, just a thought really. It's a story that I tell often about one day I arrived home, and my wife Jenny and my boy Jesse, who now is in his 20s but would have been kind of like 12 years old, they were having a constructive conversation, read argument, you know, and you would have probably had them yourselves where, you know, mother and child were arguing. They're probably arguing over the dishes or something like that, and Jesse sort of said, well, you know, I did the dishes last night, and then Jenny said, well, I did the dishes all last week, and then sort of Jesse sort of went up a level and sort of said, well, you know, I cleaned the house on the weekend, and then Jenny sort of went up a level and said, I made all your lunches last year. And, you know, it was, you know how the argument goes, and it was escalating. Until Jenny, and I was so proud of her, Jenny put out the line that I thought would completely wipe the floor with Jesse, where Jenny basically said, and I gave birth to you. Now, pretty impressive. I thought there was no coming back from that line. That is a very good line. If you're a mother, use that line. That's a very good line. And then Jesse thought for a moment, and this was his comeback, and it's a very good comeback. His comeback back was, and your generation destroyed the environment for us. And the reason why I tell that story is I'm very mindful in election year, and the thought I'll leave you with is this: I'm very mindful of election year, of who are we voting, on behalf of who are we voting? And the worry, I think, is that many of us are voting on behalf of ourselves. And actually, many of us will not be round to see the consequences long term of the votes we cast. And Jesse, my boy, in the end, had no power to vote, but he was going to live in our consequences. And somebody probably should have been thinking about him over the last few years, about what we were leaving for him. It is my great pleasure tonight. What we're going to do is we are going to hear a presentation in a moment, and then after that, we're going to have opportunity for question and answer. And so as the talk unfolds before us, I invite you to take notes and to form your questions. And then after, we'll have a orderly conversation, where this is an Anglican cathedral. We do everything according to order. This will be an orderly conversation afterwards. But it's my great pleasure to introduce a very good friend of mine, and more than a good friend. Actually, the problem of introducing this person is I have to remember all their titles and get them in the right order. And I have title envy. So I'd like to introduce to you Reverend Canon Dr. Ali Sanderson, also Bishop-elect. So since we first put on this, advertised this series, Ali has been is the Bishop-elect of the Diocese of Wellington. And so in June, we will regather her and we will consecrate her in this temple as the Assistant Bishop of this diocese, which we are very, very excited about. So it's my great pleasure to introduce to you and show your warm applause to Reverend Canon... What's the rest?
Doctor.
Doctor Bishop-elect.
Kia ora koutou. Thank you for your welcome. And thank you all for being here tonight as we gather together to begin this journey towards discerning the future of our land and our families. So as tonight is the first in this series of lectures which lead us up to the general election, I wanted to take the opportunity just to pause at this very beginning and not only speak to the specificity of the title of the talk that I've been given, which I was really excited to receive. It's a great title and got my mind really thinking, but also just to speak into the generality of this lecture series. Because this lecture, as it's been advertised in this series, is underpinned by two distinct but related thoughts. And the first is this: can we believe in politics? And the second, which is similar but subtly different and more open to interpretation, is keeping faith in politics. So this second thought asks us to engage our faith dimension of being and becoming within the political realm, keeping faith a language, a dimension, a recognized valid means of engaging in the political world. But also keeping faith in politics asks us to in some way find a way of satisfactorily also answering that first question: can we believe in politics? So that we can indeed keep faith, believe in politics itself. So tonight I want to unpack both of those two strands and how unpacking characteristically looks like in the way that I write and think is in fellowship with women theologians in these islands of the South Pacific, and that is through the imagery and reality of weaving. So when I think about something, I tend to weave the strands that are within that thought. So the strands tonight will be unwoven and then rewoven. We look at where we are, how we might have got to where we are, and how we might want to get to somewhere else. And reweaving also brings the integration of new strands. And those new strands are always pertinent to the proximity and the individuality of the weaver themselves. So the weaving, in a way that I want to effect for us tonight, is in some ways to weave a kite, which you may then choose to use as you journey through the rest of this lecture series. Something that you can carry with you and then use to contain and question the more specific, the more nitty-gritty social and environmental challenges that each of the different following lecture series focus on, right up until that final evening, which will be a conversation with politicians themselves. So I will begin and end this evening with the general background base of this series, keeping faith in politics, the question of belief in the political. And then in exploring the more specific possibility of seeking the common good in a world of self-interest, I want to weave together three particular themes. And the first of these is the physical landscape of my original land, the proximity of what it is that I weave with. And that landscape is the medieval strip fields which surround the villages of Lytton and Tideswell in Derbyshire and the death of the commons that they embody. I want to briefly compare this physical yet political landscape with some very contemporary political yet physical changes in individual and community identity politics. And I want to speak from that far away landscape as a kind of window through which we might look afresh at this land in order to question where individual and communal life and death flow here. The second strand to weave is the language of honour and the faith of honourability, a language which characterises our politicians. This language of honour is, I believe, connected to questions of belief, but it also shades how we form common unity, community, and how we bridge between the individual and the collective. So that's the second strand. The third strand to interweave within the common good and self-interested world is the interrelationship between human and non-human relations, an intersubjective relational framing to suggest how a world of self-interest, and therefore how any other kind of world, might be perceived and therefore conceived. So first, to the generality of keeping faith in politics. Now, those who are familiar with academic inquiry learn quite quickly that the first steps that we learn is usually the step of definition. How do we define the terms that we're employing so that we know not only how to employ them, but also how to explore them and then also potentially subvert them? Now, I remember very keenly my first year university journey into academia, in which I studied politics alongside geography. And I can remember sitting in the social science library in Bristol and finding book after book defining the boundaries of the political, defining the boundaries of its study and its reach. Now, I have to confess that although I did keep lots of notes in a little card file that's in my dad's attic that all got thrown out when he moved house, I can't actually remember many of the names of the theorists and the political philosophers that I read. But what I do clearly remember is at that time experiencing a deep shifting in my consciousness of what the political was. The political landscape opened up to me from a narrow sense of power, governance, and control in variously debated forms around our world to the networking of community creation. The political understood as the unavoidable realm of human interaction in community, as human beings who come together. The political in that sense, not as power games in the darkest sense of that world, but as empowering possibilities for human flourishing. And with this freshness of appreciation, I read, for example, all the letters of the founding fathers of the United States of America. Now, I say all with some degree of hesitation, but I do still say it because I can clearly remember retrieving book after book and thinking that I am going to keep reading because there's something really significant in what I'm grappling with here. I clearly remember seeing in those words not instruments of argued control and dispassionate rational pragmatism, but something of a strived for fullness of life. And I should say that I single out America not because of any other reason than it was the first political system that I studied, and it was a country that I'd just returned from. That same effect may have occurred for many other historical political systems and places. But either way, there was something in those founding father letters that were written which compelled me to keep reading. How do we live? How do we live together? How do we live together and flourish? My heart was awakened to something powerful, something beautiful, and something political, the innateness of our humanity. And in that awakening was the beginning of a very different kind of awakening, one that would not occur for many years, but there created the fertile soil. That subsequent awakening was the possibility of beauty in church politics. Now, the combined terminology of church and politics, when used colloquially often by people within the church, usually refers to the human agenda-driven wranglings within church life. But the combining of church and politics in the more innate definition of the political and in relation to the cosmic calling of the church is a divinely light-filled possibility of human and angelic flourishing. Now that is a very tantalizing thought, isn't it? That thought is almost as refreshing as a pint of beer in the back bencher at the end of a week. Well, let me leave both of those tantalizing thoughts to one side for now. And let us look more specifically now at the challenge of seeking the common good in an age of self-interest. And so to the strip fields of my village. Strip fields are very narrow fields, characterized by ribbon-like dry stone walls. And they are a significant part of the historical landscape of the White Peak District, which is my family home. Lytton and Tideswall, which is my village, is one of the best examples of this medieval strip fields that remain in the UK. These fields fan out from the hamlet of houses and farms which line the small village green. Like rays of sun, they scatter out over the hillside and down the valley on either side. And these narrow fields are now conserved through farming and conservation funding mechanisms, through the Peak District National Park Authority, and through European Union conservation schemes, the future of which may be a little bit more interesting, no doubt. But these fields and these dry stone walls are prized for their historical worth, and they're prized for the defining beauty that they give to this particularly treasured landscape. Now, the creation of these strip fields correlates to what's been described as the death of the commons in medieval England. They are the remnant of the enclosures, that period of tumultuous history in which the commonality of land gave way to individual ownership. This was a shift from communal to individual relationship to land, with corresponding familial and social shifts from subsistence agriculture to the creation of a new form of labour force. Through socioeconomic and political motivations, which are variably perceived and read back into time, common land became divided up and distributed amongst community in a time of widespread political land reform, which I should say the church was an active part. The common good of physical common land was rediscerned to be best served in creating a land of more clearly delineated self-interest. Now, whether a greater good was achieved or not in the specificity of that land is a subject of considerable debate amongst historians, historical geographers, and political philosophers, not the least of which being Karl Marx. But that is the story of my land. What are the stories of this land? What do the stories of this land say to us about common goodness? And what do the stories of this land say to us about self-interest? When I reflect on the shift away from commonality, I find myself also reflecting on a shift towards commodity. In relation to land, such a shift deeply affects human identity. And here in this land, the Fenua forms individual and communal identity profoundly. Likewise, throughout the Pacific, where, for example, in Fiji, the language of Vanua refers to land and also to people, understood as the inner part of the land. The commodification of land, therefore, correlates in part to the commodification of people. A contemporary housing crisis is tied to these deeper threads of theophilosophical interrelationships with land, and we should acknowledge that, because we need to understand and acknowledge the influence that dissonance of relational integrity might have on our formation of human identity. And that might need attending to if we as humans want to look at what we create and say, it is good. Or if we want to say that something is not as good as it could be. I'm moving now from the identity politics of land to some very contemporary identity and community politics proliferating in our world. There's been a really interesting social practice in which new language of formation of commonality is occurring. And it's hard to quite say where it began, but there is a phase of self-identification with an individual or an individual entity as a means of forming new communities of resistance or representation. The I am phenomena. We might remember Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie. One of the latest and of particular significance in the UK is the phrase, I am Daniel Blake. And this particular pattern is spurred by the film of that title, which follows the ins and outs of negotiating the social welfare system of the UK. And prominent people who wish to challenge the loss of humanity that they see can be experienced by navigating those structures self-identify, I am Daniel Blake. So this is a contemporary phenomenon of owning an individual identity in order to form a common call. I wonder if we might think of this as a somewhat interesting take on seeking or speaking about the common good in a world of self-interest. The individual, a symbol of new resistance to isolation. So what would be the names that we would use here in this land? Who might we say, I am, as a means of resistance to the loss of human integrity? But perhaps more importantly in this setting, what do I make of that trend when I am part of a people who follow a similar yet more ancient trend of I am? Yahweh's identification to Moses, I am. Jesus, who caused a riot by declaring that before Abraham was, I am. And us, those of us who put on Christ as a new creation and say that I am Christ. We who are many are one body, for we all share the one bread. I am Christ. And to our new creation, in which we are invited to co-create with Christ, do we look and say it is good? Or do we say it is not as good as it could be? So surely here is a pathway to serving and seeking the common good embodied in us in a world of self-interest. When Jesus, who asks us to pick up our cross and follow him, to be crucified with Christ, to die to self in order to be born into a new common identity, I am, that is birthed in goodness manifest. I am. Here is corporeality, that is a bodily communal identity that perhaps counters the corporatism of commodification. It is a corporeality that dies to individual self-interest in order to seek common goodness. In a few weeks' time, our friends at St. David's Church in Nainai are having a weekend-long live-in to protest the lack of accessible housing in the Hutt Valley. That live-in comes from a commitment to being community together and being for their community. They will be making tents and living on empty housing New Zealand land that's been empty for 4 years in a place where over 100 people can turn up for a tenancy application. That community is made possible by their corporeal reality in Christ, where many individuals live and breathe together with a unity of purpose, but also a unity of personhood. In that personhood, they say together, things are not as good as they could be. And in the responsive hospitality of their togetherness, an open togetherness in which others are invited to come and be at home, they themselves are part of the more good, the goodness that they seek to effect. They embody a means and an ends of seeking a common good in an age of self-interest. And so from lands that speak of death and life, to people that speak languages of death and new life, to the language of honorability. The language of honor is the language of politics. To be an elected politician is to become the right honorable. But before I speak of honor, I want to first speak to us of reverence. I, who stand appointed and anointed in our church, bear the title Reverend. There may be a few other little bits in there, but the first is always Reverend. That always comes first. My life, as my name, is to be shaped by reverence. So does that mean that I am to be the focus or symbol of reverence? Not at all. Instead, I am marked that by the responsibility to appropriately direct reverence where it is due, to revere, to point to sacred identity, to sacred commonality alive in this world, and to direct the people that I serve, including myself, to revere the right things, and to try and support us all to stop revering the wrong things. So as a person of faith, my life is dedicated to revering that which is sacred. Now, it's very hard to find anything created by God that is not sacred to God, that is not in some way holy. This calling to reverence and sacredness was brought into very sharp relief for me a couple of weeks ago in the juxtaposition of two encounters, which I want to share with you. The first one happened in the school of Wellesley, where I'm chaplain. And as chaplain of an all-boys school, we, along with many other schools, actively engaged with the White Ribbon educators a few weeks ago to come and speak in our classrooms following the incidents on social media and the subsequent school protests that happened across the way here about the rape culture identified within New Zealand. Now, as the young guy who came to our school was introduced to me, and in the introduction asked how plain his language could be to our older boys, and he did a very excellent job, by the way, but he made a very telling first comment when he met me. Introduced to me as the school chaplain and seeing me in my clerical collar, he instantly joked that he was surprised that he hadn't spontaneously combusted in my proximity. To which the teacher introducing me also joked that if that was the case, he himself would have burnt up years ago. Now, later that day, I was waiting for someone in the foyer of the National Library, and my second encounter was with Kate Shepherd. This Kate is a Perspex sculpture created by the Women's Refuge of letters compiled on top of each other, letters to New Zealand speaking of the epidemic of violence towards women. One in three women in this land are subject to physical or sexual abuse. One in three. And so as I stood looking up at Kate and thinking of my earlier encounter that day, I thought about the holiness of women. Now, I am an identifiable holy woman. I am marked sometimes physically as a woman of God. And as such, I am a symbol of the holy and sacred refining fire, albeit in humor. But it got me thinking, was there ever a day when I was not holy, when I was not a woman of God? In my own eyes, I certainly determined to grow in holiness as Christian scripture exhorts. But in God's eyes, I never was more or less holy to God. For God looks at me through Christ, the divine Fenua, the sacrificial flesh and blood, which enables many children of God to be newborn. Every woman in this land deserves appropriate reverence, as does every man, as does every child. Would that all our encounters with each other were marked by a reverential awe of sacred and holy identity, in which that which is not worthy of reverence is burnt up and disappears. Now, this sacred significance is manifold because in our intersubjective becoming, in our mutual reverence of man to woman, woman to man, parent to child, adult to child, is a respect and reverence that can bring new creativity and life. Because our co-creative intersubjectivity is life-giving. It is right that we identify and name rape culture, which is self-interest in one of its worst manifestations, and say it is bad. It is also right that we articulate that a culture of deeper reverence for our sacred identity is a possible pathway to a more common goodness. So if I am a person named in reverence, I'm called to direct the people that I serve to appropriate reverence. And I should say that I think this is even more so for those of us who come to be named Right Reverend, for we bear even greater responsibility to rightly speak of what it is right to reverence in this world. What of those who are named with honour? Could we say that that same way of thinking can carry over, that those named right, honourable, have the responsibility to rightly direct that which should be honoured? And whereas reverence may be specific to faith in any form, honour is general to all humanity. To uphold honour, to uphold manner, might that be a creative pathway to seeking common goodness? A potential pathway away from self-interest to honouring of self, honouring of other, honouring of land, honouring of sea, honouring of air. I think that this pattern of honouring is encapsulated in one of our liturgies, which prays, knowing that we are all nourished from the same source of life, may we so live that we do not deprive others of air, water, shelter, or the chance to live. And although those words are spoken as a prayer, those words speak of honour and could rightly be used in a non-faith posture. So in relation, therefore, to reverence and honour, how often do we reduce the task of honour and reverence to the specifics of self, conflating the person tasked with discerning reverence with being revered themselves, conflating the task of discerning honour to being honourable? Now, of course, the self is an important reflection of both honourability and reverence, and the two cannot be entirely divorced. But the self is the wrong starting and ending point for this context of reverence and honour. For we know, surely, that we are not as good as we could be. Which is not to say that we are not exquisitely beautiful and that our brokenness is often the most beautiful part of us. But it is given that we are fallible. We are, as the saying goes, only human. We cannot be holy as God is holy. But we can be merciful as Jesus is merciful. And such a posture subtly redirects us. So as we feel ourselves moving towards a gradual return to the underlying question of faith, belief in politics, perhaps we can see our direction of faith and belief might need a gentle realignment, that our focus is not best placed on the individual, the self, the person, but instead on the common perception and cultivation of a culture of honourability, a culture which requires a cultivation of collective consciousness. Such a move pushes us beyond the analysis of individuals and to a more common becoming. In our diocese, this has looked like a shift in terminology from questioning where are we going to questioning who are we becoming, with the answer to that question being that we are becoming we, collective consciousness, corporeal reality, new creation. Now, if this language seems a little bit vague, let me just give us a different framing as an example. There's some really interesting work and research exploring different phases of biological evolution. And one of the writing is that of Tim Flannelly, who speaks of the shift that happens from a primary era of survival of the fittest, an era marked by competition, to a secondary, more sustainable and ultimately enduring era marked instead by collaboration. Is there a possibility of such social evolution? It's an interesting thought in an election year. What language, what culture will this electioneering encourage? Will our children and our communities see a horizon of honour to which they can themselves aspire? Now, if the commentators of the USA election give us any indication of this possibility, it's not a very hopeful one. It showed, and not in the uniqueness of the candidates this year, I express, but as a downwards progression that can be noted over time towards a more base, more vindictive, more aggressive language and culture of competition in the manner of electioneering. And as Tim Flannery despairs at the ability to conserve a global commons, his hope comes not on the persuasive strength of power of an individual, but instead to an awakened global citizenship, to a shift from competition to intentional collaboration. And so to the third and final strand in this unweaving and reweaving of seeking common goodness in a world of self-interest, a move from human relationships back in some ways to human and non-human relations, back to land. Those of us who are part of our Diocese of Wellington have been made very aware by the communication of Rob Oren that we are in a new geological era, the era of the Anthropocene. We are living in an anthropic world. The creativity of humanity is the most dominant force shaping our world's reality. Whether we create in conscious or unconscious community with the rest of creation, we affect the rest of creation, and the whole of that creation is now inseparably moulded by our fingerprints, the Anthropocene. Creation's breath of life has become indivisible from the air that we choose to inhale and exhale. Tihe mori ora. What life or death have we given birth to? To what can we say it is good? To what can we say it is not as good as it could be? To have such a conversation requires us to move beyond self-interest, because ironically, our common good is now in our clear self-interest. That is, if we have ears that can hear. And so the political realm of human relationships, now more than ever, is of paramount importance for far more than humans are its subjects. How human beings decide to share the world with each other and with the non-human parts of this world is critical for our common flourishing. And that requires the cultivation of a global consciousness of being. The question that I feel is being presented to different parts of our global political realities is in some ways a return to the little strip fields of the Peak District. Is the preservation of our common creation best served by more individuated and delineated spheres of belonging and becoming? Well, so many people in our world seem to think that that is indeed the case. So who am I to argue or deign to know better. However, when I look for the sacred thread, which all weavers look for, when I look at the sacred thread of God's story interwoven in humanity and in the groaning birth pangs of creation, I see a pattern of the individual continually moving to a broader, more expansive identity, the self transposed into the common, the many who become one, the I am who opens up the divine selfhood into a proliferation of manifold embodied wisdom, the ever-expanding divine community dance of the Trinity, as Richard Rohr would exhort us to join. And to that Christ, the one who dies for the many, centered community that we are becoming, let us hear some words of scripture from the letter to the Ephesians. God's intent was that now, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God should be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly realms. God's intent was that now, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God should be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly realms. Now, last year, our wonderful creative group gathered together through the organising of the School for Religious Studies here at Victoria University for a conference entitled Woven Together, Development and Christianity Between New Zealand and the Pacific. And the opening of the conference, the then Vice-Chancellor, Professor Piri Sashia, shared a whakatauki. Ko tō amarangi ki mua, ko te hāpai o ki mure. In all change, it is our spiritual leaders who must go first. It is not the task of people of faith to stand back as a judge of the political realm, as if we are somehow separate from it, or to think that it is our role to in some way influence a separately defined political realm for our religious ends. We are all tasked with the cultivation of communities for human flourishing, but the church is called to pioneer the cultivation of a new consciousness of humanity. We are called to initiate a new world, a world beyond self-interest. Church politics is therefore not the internal human wranglings of unavoidably human institutions. True church politics are actually defined by those verses from Ephesians. Human and divine, intersubjective corporeality whose affectiveness within the earthly realms foretells redemption to the entirety of the heavenly realms. Earthly, human, and angelic flourishing. Or as the philosopher Luce Irigaray would say, the intermovement between naturality, natality, and spirituality. Now that image of earthly, human, and angelic flourishing is an expansion of the political horizon of faith and a leaning into a new category of human, non-human relations that, although a little bit mind-boggling, is one that I am compelled to believe in. And because I'm compelled to believe in that horizon, no lesser horizon will compel me. And so my hope and my prayer for all of us, and for you in particular, as you choose to journey through this lecture series, and to all of you who have the reverence and honorability to come here, and not the backbencher, straight after work on a Friday, is that you may take what I have woven together tonight and honor it for what it is, but then feel at liberty in that honoring to reweave, to untangle those threads once more and intertwine them with your own threads. And in that renewed consciousness, journey through not only this series of lectures, but your political engagement this year with a renewed divine grace, reverence and honour over you, within you, and most importantly, manifested through you. And to that end, I want to conclude with a prayer from our Anglican prayer book, which is found in the Liturgy of Thanksgiving for creation and redemption. So I invite you to pray with me as you would like. Blessed are you, God of growth and discovery. Yours is the inspiration that has altered and changed our lives. Yours is the power that has brought us to new dangers and opportunities. Set us, your new creation, to walk through this new world, watching and learning, loving and trusting, until your kingdom comes. Amen. Kia ora koutou. Thank you.
Why don't we take a moment to turn to the person next to you and just to spend a moment reflecting on if there was one part of Ali's presentation, which part particularly resonated with you or maybe caused you discomfort even. And so just share that, and then between you, if you can, formulate a question if you have one for Ali after that presentation. So I'll give you a moment to talk to the person next to you, reflect back what resonated or maybe caused you discomfort, and then start gathering some questions. So I'll give you a minute.
You're brilliant. I love it. Completely love it. After you do a talk, do you feel vulnerable?
Yeah, you always do. You need the Alison, so you need that air breathe back into you. Yeah. Return to you.
I always find it really interesting who's in the room. Who turns up, who participates, who's part of this conversation. Do you know most of them?
Probably 80%. Yeah.
It's kind of that thing where it's actually a closed conversation, and it was just a conversation, talking to the right one.
Like wet.
Is it?
Yeah. Like wet.
Yeah, it's like lots of things. Yeah. Good work. You spoke very, very well. Let's get some questions, eh?
Kia ora koutou. Then let us move to question and answer. So Derek has got a microphone there. If you would like to ask a question, it'd be really good if you did ask a question, then just indicate and Derek will bring you the microphone, and then we can put Ali on the spot. No. We can engage in good discourse. So question up here. Wonderful.
I'm very minded that in the church calendar for tomorrow, there's a commemoration of Frederick Morris, priest and theologian, who I understand developed the idea of Christian socialism, and he was reviled by Christians and rejected by socialists. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you have any comment on that in the light of what you said about the common good.
It is really interesting when we try and explore the connections between groups that aren't always working together in a commonality. And I know that myself, thinking as a feminist and as a Christian, that those groups don't go together very well often, and so you end up being reviled by both. And I think that speaks to that deeper sense between us of how do we engage in collaborative work, and how are we trained in the way that we think to build together as opposed to deconstruct and separate. We've got to get the things right. And I remember making this very conscious shift in some of my writing a long time ago, feeling that I was trained in a combative form of discourse to find the thing that was wrong. You know, there's always this delight when you found you'd proved somebody wrong in a reading, or you'd found a miss in the argument that you could then kind of nail that person. And that whole combative style just felt completely antithetical to so much of what I was feeling. How I wanted to write and how I wanted to think. And so making a choice that whenever I wrote about somebody, that I would honour them as I wrote about them. And so trying in my writing never to denigrate the work of the other people, even if it was to say something that might be very contrary, but to speak in a way that recognised the gifts that people had given. And I think that that's what I would kind of urge us towards in terms of that collaborative consciousness of how do we intentionally seek to build one another up. Because our scripture says to be careful lest you devour one another. And I think we're very good at doing that. And we haven't had as much training to build one another up.
Thank you so much for such a thoughtful exploration of all those issues in so many different angles. I was desperate by about the 40th minute for you to say the word community. And I saw that you entered into the word community and the exploration of it about minute 46 or thereabouts. And I suppose as a feminist and also an ordained minister, what came to mind for me was that my father, who was also ordained Presbyterian minister, used to say, we are created for community. Mm. We are created for community. And I know that as a feminist, there's all sorts of critiques of communities that it papers over abuses of power. And so I wonder if you would speak a bit more about the potential and the dangers of talking about community, because I still put my faith in community and I still believe that I'm created for community.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. And thinking from the background of community development, that is one of the critiques that often comes out, that the word community is used superficially, and that hides some of the imbalances of power or the imbalance, the challenge to form that connection. And unity is how do you form. What's happening over in Nainai is this eclectic group of people who are becoming with each other because they have common unity in Christ. And I think that is a deep call that has been resonated from feminists and from other community workers to ask us to more critically be aware of the phrasing of community. So we can find it in its fullness. Is it coming out? Bits and pieces. I use this one. Yeah. Yeah. That challenge to form community with deep reverence and to go deeper. And I think that's the biggest challenge I feel for our churches, is that there's an era in which the church was at the heart of community. And we're in a place now where our parish churches are not necessarily the heart of the community, the places where they are. And that gives us a real challenge, because those communities can form without the presence of churches. And so we have that call to rediscover Christ-centered community, which is distinctive and enables that deeper sense of unity together. And I think that going deeper with each other in journeying is one of the biggest challenges and joys of being church at the moment.
Thank you for your lecture and the wonderful vision that you projected. Could I bring the conversation back to politics, which I guess is the overall objective of these lectures? Last year in the law faculty, somebody gave a lecture which identified the values of service and stewardship as the core values at the heart of our system of governance. We don't have a constitution, but if you look at the way government is set up and it's supposed to work, these are the two core or key values. Now, as one looks around to who to vote for at the next election, which was the question that was posed, do we look for people who serve the whole community rather than sectional interests, and people who in their stewardship get things done efficiently as sort of guidelines for who to vote for? Or are we actually in a irreducibly pluralist society with MMP where the political system is unavoidably conflictual? You have to take sides. Would you like to comment on some of that?
Yeah, thank you, Raymond. Yeah, it's really, really challenging when our political system, as you say, is combative. How you then engage with that. And I'm just reflecting a little bit this last little while of a friend of mine who... She ended up being on the news quite a lot after Fidel Castro died because she became an expert of the Cuban system. And hearing the way that she reflected on the elections that happen within a Cuban system that is not democratic as we might identify it, made me, and she was comparing that with the US election. And I think our MMP system is quite different, again, from the American system. So the very combative nature of the American one and, you know, the UK first past the post, here that there is more potential for collaboration and there is more potential to ask our politicians how they intend to collaborate and how they intend to serve our communities through possibilities of collaboration. And I think it's very interesting when, I remember when we had the last election and we had our politicians speak to us about child poverty, that you can often tell if somebody is speaking with that collaborative mind to address the issue and the solutions of the issue, as opposed to speaking of the preference of their party and denigrating other parties. And I would suggest that as we listen to those conversations this year, we look to where that service is, because we can find the possibility in this political system that people will die to self-interest in some way, their own political party self-interest, in order to serve a common good, because that has a potential here that in other countries it doesn't have in the same way.
Thank you. As you sort of intimated, God will redeem all things, even the way we do politics in the new creation. But that still kind of leaves open the question, what should our attitude as Christians, speaking as one, be towards it, our politics as it is now? How passive should we be in the face of it? How supportive? Should we be antagonistic even? Or should we just run away? It's a real question, especially in the States right now, whether we should actually begin to hermetically seal ourselves off, you know, to protect our distinctive holiness. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, thank you. I think the risk of disengaging, I think it's always challenging to know how to engage with something which may be harmful. And I think that's the question at the moment, where some things seem harmful. But yet I feel that in all things, the opportunity to engage is one that we must live into. Because, as I said before, human flourishing is all of our responsibility. And the risk is, if we disengage, that we think that somehow we are above and beyond
and don't embrace our own brokenness and don't embrace the fact that our churches may not necessarily represent a better human flourishing than a political House of Commons debate. And so I think it's kind of part of our humility that we do engage. I do also think that when we engage with something that might be harmful, that there are kind of four postures that I think are helpful to keep in mind for all people. And that is the posture of subjection, submission, surrender, and subversion. And we have the possibility of leaning into any of those four things in any way. So to speak of subjection, there are some things to which we are subject to, of which we have no power over. And we have in Christ someone who knows what that is like. So we can be subject to things, and we can know the solidarity of the divine grief and grace in our subjection. But we can also submit, and we can choose to submit in power to things. So we choose to submit to one another. So engaging in the political is a way of choosing to submit to other human beings in our mutual fallibility. And then you can surrender. And so surrender is something that we do in fullness of letting go of power to God and to other things we may choose to surrender to. So the distinction between submission and surrender is submission is a holding on intentionally, and surrender is a letting go intentionally. And then there is the fourth posture of subversion. And we know that Christ is a powerful subverter of political and religious power and control. And so we can find in Christ a divine community and divine energy for holy subversion. And those four postures might be helpful for us as we think about how to engage in the political.
You've just used the expression a divine community. Isn't this something that we should be really concentrating on it? Because it seems that we're at the mercy of every other conceivable community you can think of. We should somehow get ourselves together and say, this is what we believe as Christians. And not only do we just believe it, but we've got authority that goes way back into the Old Testament with the prophets who spoke. And then after Jesus, we have the Holy Spirit. Now, surely we should make ourselves open to what is available there, and that can guide our thinking. And then we can build up, as it were, a Christian body of public opinion. How are we going to do that in actual practice? Some people say we should have Christian villages, for example, where people can really become growing as Christians. And, of course, this has already happened in this diocese to some extent. So maybe we should be doing more of building up Christian public opinion.
Thank you. Well, it's always a real challenge to know how to form that common unity, that community of Christ, and knowing that Christians can believe very different things and often do choose to believe quite different things. And I find that people who spend a lot of time in kind of contemplative time with God and thinking of that sense of Christian villages. The kind of monasteries were known as villages of God back in the Celtic days of the land, and part of thinking of the rebuilding of the church. Nehemiah is this villages without walls, this idea of being villages and being Christian community. That within that is always a rhythm of connection with God. And I find that the more time you spend in contemplation with God, the more easy it is to see your own ego reflected in God. And the more the silence of God seems appropriate, and the more a connection and submission to one another without always saying that we know what is right and what is wrong. And so I think a model of Christian community is based on that mutuality of submission, and yet at the same time, to be able to form common identity together when we say this is not as good as it could be. And that's what we've done, you know, together as a diocese. And that example from Nainai of saying this is not as good as it can be, and with the refugee response to say we can do better. And there are ways in which we can form community where we can work out together what it is that we believe we can say is not as good as it can be, and how we can journey with a gentleness and yet a power of transformation. But any of those things requires such a wisdom and gentleness of submission to each other, so that we don't end up replicating a combative culture where some Christians will believe this and some believe that, and therefore have a debate as who's blessed most by Christ. And so that challenge comes back to that forming of a different consciousness of being humans together.
Thank you, Ellie. It seems to me that woven through what you've been talking about is a big emphasis on aspects of justice and the fight for justice, but not fighting as we classically think of fighting as combat, but finding other ways, gentler ways. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more about how we fight for justice, but we do that through our humanity, our shared humanity, and our empathy, and particularly how we do that from our different gendered, sexed, raced positions.
Thank you. It makes me think of that other part within Ephesians that speaks of the manifold wisdom of God. You know, sometimes think of the weaving, the many-coloured wisdom of God. And I think at the heart of justice in many ways is being able to articulate our own embodied experiences of injustice. And so conversations of which we're enabled to be in safe vulnerability is the first step, in which we can be together and share with that inter-reverence for each other where our injustice is, and to be able to be heard. And then in hearing that, to then do that kind of complicated and critical work of deconstructing where those injustices form, and therefore how can more just ways be created together. And it's a little bit, it makes me think a little bit of the work we did around international development and religion, where we kind of shifted the policy landscape from being about what was considered right or wrong, to how do we have this conversation with each other. And if you get the conversation with each other about how do we speak religiously in a multi-plural world, how do we speak of justice and injustice, when the reality will be that we will all be subject to injustices, and we will all in those communities, we will all injure each other in some way, but we will also heal each other. And to be able to form communities of healing requires that ability to lean into our own vulnerabilities with each other. And that's that weird upside downness of the kingdom of God, that, you know, we have this cross that in some way makes that which is weak powerful, which makes no sense in lots of ways. But that subversion of power, that subversion of injustice to justice, is a foundation on which we can begin to share and build networks of recreative passions together.
Ali, let me take a gap in the questions just to ask one, and it continues on from your one, really, and I was just, you made the comment in your talk, we cannot be holy, but we can be merciful. And I thought there's a lovely moment. And there's a passage in James that talks about, I can't get the exact wording, but basically talks about mercy trumps justice. And taken to your question around fighting for justice, do you want to comment on, I think often, some of the most aggressive people I know are the justice people. And talk Can you want to talk about the place of mercy in relationship to justice?
I'm just thinking of what comes to mind is it's actually a poem written by a friend, Alison Phipps, a professor in Glasgow University, who's part of the Iona community, and she writes this poem that talks about binding the strong man, that imagery in the gospel, and some of you may be familiar with the work of Ched Myers, who talks about binding the strong man, of really wrestling for social justice, and that being the call of the church to wrestle for justice in the world and to reveal that which is unjust, to reveal that which is systemic abuse of human flourishing. And in this poem, she talks about unless he first binds the strong man. And she says, how can women of poverty engage in that? Because it's unless he. And she then uses this beautiful imagery of the way that women in the Gospels articulate with exuberance, love and mercy. And the women that cry at the feet of Jesus, that anoint him with oil, these moments of outpouring of love and outpouring of mercy that in some way disarm and bind the strong man in their own way. And I think that moving into different forms of strength and different forms that are honoured gives a pathway into different forms of mercy and the way that we perceive mercy. So it's kind of like a bilingual approach to binding the strong man. One needs the other and the other needs the first. Might be time to go to the backbencher.
Ali, we would like to thank you for your outstanding presentation tonight, especially as the first of the series and as it leads us into election year. So I think it's appropriate at this moment that we show our appreciation to Ali. Just before we go to phase two at the backbencher, I'm just going to pass it over to Derek from Otago Public Theology. Thank you, Derek.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Derek Woodard-Lehman. I teach in the Theology and Religion Department at University of Otago, but I'm based here in Wellington as part of the Center for Theology and Public Issues. So thanks so much for coming out to this, the first in our six-part series leading up to the September election. If you look on your chair or at the chair next to you, you should have gotten one of these little green third sheets that gives you all the information you need for next month's event on Thursday, 27 April, in the upstairs of J.J. Murphy's Pub on Cuba Mall. So we'll skip right to the backbencher, start out with pints in hand. And that's going to be a public issues conversation, and it's going to be hosted by Radio New Zealand editor and on-air host Megan Whelan. And it will be on the subject of the least and the last in a world of growing inequality. It should be a really good time. It should be a fun environment. And as this evening has been beautiful and I think appropriately and wonderfully reverential, that conversation might be a wee bit irreverent. So if you have neighbors who might not turn up to an event at a cathedral, this would be a good one to get them to turn out to, because everybody likes the pub, right? But before we dismiss, just let me say thank you first to Reverend Digby Wilkinson and the staff here at the Cathedral for hosting us, to Bishop Justin Duckworth for serving as moderator and facilitator, and above all to Reverend Canon Dr. Eleanor Sanderson. I myself come from a very low church tradition by way of sacrament, but a very high church tradition by way of oratorical tradition. And back home in the U.S., as you might have guessed from my voice, we not only think it's important to get it right, we think it's important to say it right. And I want to thank you, Ellie, so very much for not only getting it right, but for saying it right. It was not only brilliant and erudite and on point in terms of our topic and theme, the best sort of setup for the series that I can imagine. It was said with wonderful imagery and depth and passion. So on both counts, on both the virtue of getting it right and on the virtuosity of saying it right. Thank you so much on behalf of the center, the university, and the wider Wellington community. Please join me one more time in saying thank you to Ellie. That said, good night, God bless, and if you see one of these lying around, take it with you, give it to your coworker, your neighbor, your over-the-road friend, and hope to see you a month from now on 27 April at J.J. Murphy's.